The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, welcome. My name is Susanna Sakoto. I know many of you see some familiar faces. I run the War Crimes Research Office here at the school, and I teach in the related areas of international criminal law and procedure. We run a war crime speaker series throughout the academic year, and we're very excited to have with us today our guest speaker, Håkan Freeman. Håkan Freeman is the Deputy Director General at the Swedish Ministry of Justice, Division for Criminal Cases and International Judicial Cooperation. He's also a visiting professor at University College London of the Faculty of Law. He's represented Sweden in the ICC negotiations since 1996, 2 years before the Rome Statute was signed. And mainly on issues of procedural law and international legal cooperation, but he's also chaired formal, informal meetings of the working groups on procedural law at the Rome Conference, and later in the preparatory committee for the ICC Rules of Procedure and Evidence. He's been a consultant to the prosecutor of the ICC, lectured extensively on international criminal law, and he's co-author of an introduction to international criminal law and procedure published by Cambridge University Press. With that said, let me turn it over to Håkan Freeman. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. When I started at the Swedish Ministry of Justice, the very first file that was handed over to me was some kind of negotiation in the UN. Probably won't turn out to be much. They've been doing this since the 1950s. And I got two removal boxes of papers, and that was back in 1995 or 1996. And after that, the ICC and the negotiations have followed me, or maybe me following them, over the years. And it's a quite exciting area of law, both the substantive law, the institutional law, the procedural law that I've focused in particular on, and not the least the kind of politics and policies surrounding these type of crimes and these type of proceedings. Because all these crimes have a political facet, if you like. The investigations and prosecutions are conducted in an environment of high politics, normally. Many of the suspects, later accused, later convicted persons, are also politically connected and holding political positions. Normally, they've done that in the past when they show up before one of these courts. And, as a lawyer, of course, what one is trying to do with each and every one of these courts is to create a unique, separate legal system. So you will have a criminal code with both substantive crimes, with all the general principles of criminal law, and you will have a separate code of criminal procedure, which is developed by lawyers from very many different states and legal traditions, coming together, of course, heavily biased in favor of their own system, because that's essentially the only one you know, so it must be good. And secondly, because what the other guys are doing seems a little bit suspicious. I don't really know what it is, and some of it is odd. Still, whether it's the judges of ICTY and ICTR coming together, or 150 odd negotiators from different states coming together to do the ICC, somehow you need to strike a balance and try to find procedures that would roughly satisfy observers from different quarters of the world. Because everyone need to appreciate the proceedings of these courts to be reasonably fair and reasonably legal and reasonable in general, right? Otherwise, these will be completely Mickey Mouse trials somewhere. So, the criminal procedures of the ICC represent a compromise. They contain elements of different legal traditions, and they provide a unique blend of such elements. Much of this untested. Of course, we had the experiences of ICTY and ICTR to draw upon. They had done it, and what they did worked reasonably well. So that was a benchmark, but there were also drawbacks with those procedures, in particular in the eyes of many civil law lawyers, who, of course, realized that the first set of rules of procedure and evidence of ICTY were essentially the federal rules of criminal procedure of the US. The French were not terribly impressed. Okay. The confirmation of charges process was a hotly contested issue in the ICC negotiations. And of course, domestic systems take very different approaches. You may have contested hearings on the one hand, you may have ex parte written proceedings on the other hand, and on written material only. Whether you should have a formal test or a test of sufficient evidence, etc. So, a whole range of different issues that had to be addressed and where we had to navigate through the various options to create some kind of process for the ICC. Also, the various international and internationalized criminal jurisdictions have opted for very different solutions. You have the Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals operating with a committee of chief prosecutors, but no judicial review of the charges. You have ICTY and ICTR and the Special Court for Sierra Leone, all having a quick and rather simple judicial procedure, a written one, ex parte, with a prima facie test, and doing this prior to any arrest warrant being issued. So basically what you do is reviewing the charges and the underlying evidentiary material for the purpose of issuing an arrest warrant. Then you have the arrest warrant, you have the person arrested, surrendered, and all of a sudden you start all over again. And quite often the charges were also amended after the actual arrest and surrender of the person. Well, for the first time you got the version of the accused person, and after that the prosecutor had to do different things to adjust to new realities. You have the Special Tribunal for Lebanon, which also essentially runs the scheme of ICTY and ICTR. It's very similar, but it also has a number of additional features. Some of the judges had experience from ICTY, and they also knew some of the drawbacks of the ICTY process. So therefore, in light of that experience, they introduced some special features. That court, the pre-trial judge, is allowed to request the prosecutor to submit additional material, which is a novelty compared to ICTY, at least in written form. And also, there is a possibility to refer preliminary matters to the appeals chamber for resolution in the confirmation process. So certain legal issues can be sorted out with authority already at the confirmation stage. ICC. A much more complex process with a hearing and potentially contested charges and oral evidence. We also have the issue of victims' participation, which is unique to the ICC compared to the other international courts and tribunals. And the fact that this is not the basis for issuance of an arrest warrant. This is a separate process which happens after the person has been arrested or summoned to appear before the ICC. So it's something else, and it has to be compared, not the least in evidentiary terms, to the arrest process, which is separate, and the later trial, which is also a different process. And then we have the extraordinary chambers of the Court of Cambodia, which runs an essentially civil law procedure-based process. There is not a confirmation of charges in the sense that we know from the other courts and tribunals, but rather a system with investigating judges reviewing charges and issuing a so-called closing order at the end. So there is a type of judicial review, but it's very different from the confirmation process of the other court. So, confirmation of charges and this process has been the subject of review by the War Crimes Research Office. A full report on that particular issue was released in October 2008. But at that stage, only two cases had gone through this process. Now we can take stock of further development within the ICC. I should also mention that this particular issue of confirmation of charges has been addressed in other reports by the War Crimes Research Office as well. Not the least, a report concerning the responsibility of defining the case against the accused. That report is of November 2009. The practice of cumulative charging, a report of May 2010, and one of the most recent reports from June of this year on measures for expediting the proceedings. And of course, this is a very large part of the process and a rather time-consuming part of the process, and therefore it's natural that it will be reviewed when you look at various procedural issues relating to the ICC. The full report, as I said, came in the early life of the court. Still, it was critical of certain aspects of the process, in particular with respect to delays and the disclosure practice that operated then, and which may be even more confused today. And on the issue of the unclear participation of victims at this stage of the process and with respect to amendments of charges. So a number of problematic issues that resulted in recommendations being made for rethinking some of the policy choices that the court had made in its early operations. So, for myself, having taken active part in the negotiations and the drafting of the ICC procedures, including the provisions on confirmation of charges, I'm very happy to be able to elaborate on this issue here today. Not the least, since I personally have always been rather concerned about some aspects of the rules that we came up with in Rome and later in the rules of procedure and evidence for the court. And as a matter of fact, also in the regulations of the court, which is an instrument adopted by the judges, and a process in which I represented the office of the prosecutor. But I'll leave that for a different talk some other time. I will outline the statutory scheme and explain some of the thinkings when the rules were drafted, and then try to do a quick review of the case law so far produced by the court. So, in each criminal jurisdiction, the purpose of judicial review of charges is essentially the same: to provide a judicial check against prosecutorial abuse and overreaching, and secondly, to streamline the charges for trial, and thirdly, to facilitate trial proceedings. However, the purpose of this process is not to reach final conclusion on competing submissions about the materials or to make a finding as to the credibility or reliability of the evidence presented. It's not meant to produce what's sometimes labeled a mini trial. It's something else. And it's clear that there are a number of competing interests at play at this very stage of the process. So when the confirmation of charges process was developed for the ICC, there were different schools of thought in play. Some wanted a very quick and simple review, essentially the same as what you have at ICTY and ICTR, and the basis for issuance of an arrest warrant, no more than that. So the confirmation would then be a written, non-contested procedure, and proper disclosure would take place only afterwards. Some wanted a real substantive review of the prosecutor's case in order to streamline the charges and iron out all legal issues outstanding prior to trial. Preferably, full disclosure should then take place before the confirmation hearing as such, and the case should be prepared for an almost immediate transfer into the trial phase and start of the trial after confirmation. The compromise was somewhere in between those positions. An unclear question was whether disclosure should take place both prior to the confirmation hearing and for the purpose of the confirmation process and also afterwards, or if there should only be one disclosure of all evidence, exculpatory, incriminatory, prior to the confirmation process. And then if only part of that would then be used for the confirmation or not. The confirmation process, as I said, takes place after an arrest warrant or summons to appear has been issued. So it's a separate process and it's unrelated to arrest warrants. Generally, the suspect will be present and have the opportunity to participate actively in the confirmation process. The modalities here are more complex and therefore time-consuming than before the ad hoc tribunals. And it involves a robust disclosure process, the filing of document containing the charges. We don't speak of indictment, and generally speaking in the ICC procedures, technical terms are avoided in order not to kind of misread them or read them with your domestic classes. But that also makes the text much more cumbersome. Try to find, you know, short language for describing someone as a suspect without calling him or her that. And you get a long and difficult paragraph. So I will sometimes refer to indictment, but the proper name is document containing the charges, with an acronym since it's so long. And oral hearing, in which both the prosecution and the defense can present evidence and challenge the evidence of the other side. So it starts to smell a little bit of a trial here, doesn't it? The charges and the supporting evidence is scrutinized more rigorously here than in the review proceedings of the ad hoc tribunals. And it culminates in a lengthy and reasoned confirmation decision. And that's the setup laid down in the statute. So it's nothing that the court itself has come up with. That's what they've been directed to do. We also have the issue of victim participation. I won't address that particularly here, but it's self-evident that if you let yet another player into the process with individual rights and the right to appear and do things, that will also have to be defined, which is not very well or done in very detailed terms in the legal instruments of the ICC. And secondly, you must make it operational in practice, which the court has struggled quite a bit with over the last few years. And I must admit that I considered the confirmation process to be perhaps the weakest point or part of the ICC proceeding. And one which could potentially be very slow, very cumbersome, and the process as devised in the statute leave room for a mini trial, clearly, for clouding the respective roles of the parties and of the court, for complicating the relationship between the pre-trial chamber conducting the confirmation process and the subsequent trial chamber. Should findings and legal interpretations made by the former, by the pretrial chamber, bind the latter, the trial chamber? And if so, to what extent? I mean, the trial chamber is meant to independently review and adjudicate the case. If you've had your brothers and sisters making lots of interpretations in a 150-page long decision before you, it may be rather difficult to depart from that. And if you do, to what extent will you have to take that into account at all? So it complicates matter if this is a very full process. And thereafter, the trial chamber needs to do its own very independent assessment of the same legal and factual issues. And there is a distinct risk that the pretrial judges would overinterpret the role and mandate, particularly in the early life of the court, when they have not so much to do, and by doing so, setting a standard that a busier court later will not have a chance to adhere to without substantive delays as the result. The developing practice of the ICC pretrial chambers has strengthened some of these concerns, and I will point to the major ones during the rest of this talk. So far, the ICC has conducted confirmation processes resulting in a decision in 5 cases, 2 relating to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, 1 relating to the Central African Republic, and 2 relating to the Sudan conflict, the Darfur conflict. In addition, confirmation hearings have been held in 3 more cases, 2 Kenya cases and yet another Democratic Republic of Congo case. But we have not seen any decisions coming out of that as of yet. The defendants have participated actively in most of the confirmation processes, including in the hearings. Some suspects were arrested and transferred to the court. Some appeared voluntarily after summons. 2 suspects waived the right to participate in the confirmation hearing, and the hearing was held in their absence. I will return to disclosure. The hearings have lasted for several days in most cases and have, in many of these cases, included live witness testimony, in some cases also by defense witnesses. In the first 2 confirmation processes, the 2 covered by the report, the hearings themselves lasted for more than 2 weeks each. The next case lasted only for 4 days, which was an improvement. The following 2 Sudan cases, one lasted for 10 days and one for 1 day only. And that was, of course, the one where no one showed up. The most recent Democratic Republic of the Congo case lasted for 6 days in September of this year. And the 2 Kenya cases, which include multiple defendants, lasted 9 and 15 days respectively. So, they were long, they were shorter, and now they've been slightly longer again. It appears, though, that the longer cases, or the longer hearings have been held in cases with multiple defendants, which makes sense, that they will be a bit longer than with a single defendant. In the 2 Kenya cases, the 2 most recent cases where we don't have decisions yet, the defendants wanted to call a huge number of witnesses, 43 in all, in one of the cases. And the pretrial chamber found that to be manifestly excessive, and it ordered the accused to limit the number of witnesses to a maximum of 2 each. And as far as I can recall, I don't think they called 2 each. I think they called a lesser number than 2 defense witnesses each. I mean, they joined around a few witnesses. And the pretrial chamber also recalled that written statements would suffice with respect to other witnesses that they wanted to introduce in the confirmation process. So, a clear example of the pretrial chamber taking an active management over this process. In one case, a law professor appeared. He was part of the defense team, and he gave a very long and detailed expose and explanation interpretation of the charges against the law, the substantive criminal law of the ICC, not as an expert, but as a defense team member, a German professor. In all these cases, the hearing has been held, and after that, written submissions made by the parties, by the prosecutor, by the defense, and normally by legal representatives for victims, defense going last. The decisions have in most cases been given within the stipulated 60-day period. That's a self-imposed time limitation that the judges agreed in the regulations of the court, 60 days, but it's 60 days from the last submission made in the case, so not from the hearing. In the Kenya cases, the judges have decided with reference to security of victims, but that seems to be more of a fig leaf, that they want to render the decision in both cases at the same time. And of course you have defendants on one side of the fence in one case and on the other side in the other. And they don't want to kind of upset half the public opinion first and the other half the week later. So it's probably quite reasonable to give both decisions in one go. So they delayed the first decision with a couple of weeks. They've been lengthy. The shortest one so far is 75 pages, the decision. The longest one is 213, plus a dissenting opinion. That's something. On the other hand, arrest warrants or decisions on whether an arrest warrant should be issued or not would in a domestic system be a maximum 2-pager, 3-pager perhaps. Here, they easily run over 50, 60, 70 pages. So I guess confirmation on over 75 or 150 is fine then in light of that. Now, there is a real problem with long decisions. And as I said, the more they dig down in details and also in a recent decision explain very detailed how they assess evidence and legal issues, the more it looks like a trial rather than something else. In one case, the chamber adjourned the proceedings and requested the prosecution to consider amending the charges, which the prosecutor also did. I will return to that. And that, of course, prolonged the process a little bit. The purpose of the confirmation process has been stated in a number of decisions. And one pretrial chamber in one of the early cases held that a confirmation hearing is neither a trial before the trial nor a mini trial, but rather the main goal is to ensure that no case goes to trial unless there is sufficient evidence to establish substantial grounds to believe that the person committed the crime with which he or she has been charged. Well, that's language taken out of the statute, so it's not rocket science. The appeals chamber had a chance to underline and really underscore that this is something different. And did so with respect to the right to challenge evidence. And it stated that it must be understood in the context of the confirmation hearing, which does not amount to a determination of the guilt or innocence of the suspect. So it's something different. It also recalled the evidentiary standard, which is lower than beyond a reasonable doubt standard for a conviction. But they didn't say that here, but it's a higher standard than the evidentiary standard for issuance of an arrest warrant. So it's somewhere in between. And the appeals chamber also concluded that the prosecutor may be able to convince the pretrial chamber that the threshold for the confirmation of the charges has been reached, even if the reliability of the witness and other evidence was not fully tested. It's a different process and it's a different standard. And also one of the pretrial chambers confirmed that the admissibility of evidence at this stage is without prejudice to the trial chamber's exercise of its functions and powers to make a final determination as to the admissibility or probative value of any evidence. So what they do should not affect and prejudice what the trial chamber has to do later on. So far, so good. Nonetheless, a very robust disclosure process has been established already at this stage, underscoring the filter function of the process. And the disclosure is supervised by a single judge of the pretrial chamber. So both the prosecution and the defense must provide each other and the court with the evidence upon which it intends to rely at the hearing. So at least the evidence that is necessary for the purpose of the confirmation hearing and the confirmation process. That means that there will normally not be full disclosure at this stage, and you would need another set of full disclosure once the charges have been confirmed, but before trial. So you would have a double disclosure process. There have been differences, though, between different pretrial chambers. We all thought it was clear that the disclosure that takes place prior to the confirmation hearing was disclosure of material that's necessary and called by the parties for the confirmation process purposes. But one pretrial chamber said, no, that's not enough. You need to file on the record of the case all evidence that you've disclosed between the parties. So a full disclosure, regardless of whether that evidence is to be used in the confirmation process or not. And that has to be done prior to the confirmation hearing, because the chamber needs that material in order to fulfill a truth-seeking mission that it considers itself to have. Well, that turns things upside down, doesn't it? So you will need certain evidence, and you would allow summarized and summary evidence and other things to be used, written statements to be used in the confirmation process that would not necessarily be admissible for trial, but it's admissible and usable in the confirmation process, and still you'll have to do full disclosure prior to the confirmation hearing, available not only to the other party but also to the court in order for the court to fulfill certain functions. This was done in the Bemba case, the one relating to the Central African Republic. That chamber took a different stance on a whole range of issues, so maybe that was the odd one out. Unfortunately, it's been repeated in the two Kenya cases that came afterwards, and the same practice has been utilized in those cases. And now we're not quite sure what the requirements are. The more limited disclosure for confirmation, or full disclosure before confirmation, regardless of whether all that material will be used in the confirmation process or not. Quite unfortunate that it's not clarified, and you can probably hear from the way I presented that I'm not entirely convinced that full disclosure reads very well with the confirmation process as drafted in the ICC statute. I should also say a few words about the document containing the charges, the indictment not to be called an indictment, where the requirements for the content of that document are rather strict and rather comprehensive. And so a statement of the facts which provide a sufficient legal and factual basis to bring the accused to trials, including facts with respect to jurisdiction. Well, that sounds familiar to any legal system, I guess. And also legal characterization of the facts to accord both with the ICC crimes and the precise form of participation. This is a reaction to ICTY and ICTR, where as to the form of participation, the prosecutor in all indictments only repeated the language of the statute. So all forms of participation were argued in the indictment, and then they would do some pick and choose exercise during trial. Here the ICC has said, no, that's not good enough, you need to be more precise than that. Which, of course, in the eyes of the defendant, is very useful. Otherwise, you defend yourself against a very broad range of different forms of criminal liability. Also, these requirements have been given significant consequences in practice, and it's been held that each item of evidence that is being presented must be linked to the factual statement it intends to prove. So you need to do that linkage. And each factual statement must be linked to the specific element of the crime or mode of liability. So quite onerous requirements for the prosecution to specify what the evidence is good for and what it relates to. It is a considerable burden for the prosecution. On the other hand, it provides the defendant and the court with much better information as to what he or it needs to prepare in with respect to preparation of the defense, but also for the purpose of the confirmation process and for the later trial process. So difficult, yes. Useful, also yes, if you like. The standard required for confirmation is whether there is sufficient evidence to establish substantial grounds to believe that the person committed each of the crimes charged. So, sufficiency of evidence, and the real standard is substantial grounds to believe. Which sounds familiar, but perhaps not. Using a dictionary and European Court of Human Rights practice, one pretrial chamber said strong grounds for believing, and I guess that's as close as one gets in trying to decipher what it means. What the chambers have done in practice is to examine very thoroughly each element of the crimes and the modes of liability charged and assessed whether the evidentiary standard has been met. And in the Lubanga case, in the first confirmation case, the chamber also rejected a defense based on the principle of legality and mistake of law. So they also went into legal and evidentiary assessment of something argued by the defendant at the confirmation stage. The ICC statute provides three different possible outcomes. The first is that charges are confirmed. The second is that the court declines to confirm charges, so they can be confirmed in whole or in part. And the third is the court adjourning the hearing and requesting the prosecutor to either provide further evidence or to consider amending charges with respect to a crime different from the one that was argued in the first indictment. In one of the DRC cases, most of the charges were confirmed. In one of the Sudan cases, all were rejected due to insufficient evidence. In the Sudan case, where the defendants or suspects did not show up, all charges were confirmed. In the Bemba case that I mentioned, the chamber adjourned the hearing and requested the prosecutor to amend the charges, or to consider amending the charges, I should say, which he later did, and most of them were confirmed. But the chamber there took a very clear stance against cumulative charges and rejected those charges which it found to be cumulative. I will return to that. In the very first confirmation hearing in the Lubanga case, the pretrial chamber entered into an exercise of recategorizing some of the charges, that is, relabeling some of the counts and saying, no, it's not this type of war crime, it's that type of war crime instead, before confirming them. And I will focus in the last bit of this talk on the Bemba and Lubanga decisions. So, Lubanga, where the recategorization of charges was conducted, the chamber confirmed charges against the accused as a co-perpetrator, but on a different legal basis than the one set out by the prosecutor in the indictment. The prosecutor had argued these are certain type of war crimes conducted in a non-international armed conflict, which is regulated by certain rules. And the chamber said, based on the material presented to it, no, these should be charged as war crime conducted in an international armed conflict, in spite of the prosecutor very clearly not choosing to charge under that heading, but rather on the other. The prosecutor tried to appeal, but leave to appeal was denied, which seems to be very common practice in this court, in particular when the issues are very controversial or difficult. There are regulations, the ICC regulations adopted by the ICC judges, which include something that the states could never agree on when we negotiated the statute. There are provisions on so-called recategorization of charges, where you allow the court to be the master of interpretation of law and say, based on the facts and the charges presented to me, I will not convict for this crime, but I will convict for that crime instead. And then there is a process, and to some of us that's quite normal. It's the principle of jura novit curia, which has been around since the Romans, and we're quite comfortable with it. To others, this is complete crap, isn't it? I mean, what you answer to is a crime being charged, and the court can't change that crime. What are you then answering to? So we have very different views as to this. That's why the states and state negotiators could not agree on it. The judges could, coming from different legal traditions, they said, well, we should apply this principle, but the parties, everyone appearing before this court should know this in advance, and there should be certain safeguards around it. And therefore they drafted the rules, the regulations of the court, including this provision, Regulation 55, and also introducing the necessary safeguards. All of them coming from European Court of Human Rights case law, by the way. So, reasonable, and you may take different views on whether this is good or bad, but it's there and it's very clear. The question now remaining is, should this be for use at trial only, or should it be used already at the confirmation stage? Should the pretrial chamber, when confirming charges or considering whether to confirm, also enter into the exercise of recategorization? While the Lubanga pretrial chamber thought it should, and they did, the prosecutor was not very happy. The trial chamber afterwards was even less happy, because I don't know where they will land, but maybe they will agree with the prosecutor's initial submission that this is not an international armed conflict. Where will that go? What will then the trial chamber need to do? Yet again, recategorize perhaps. So there might be tools for dealing with it, but it creates a rather messy process. Arguably, application of this mechanism at the confirmation stage is inconsistent with the statute and the very clear three options provided in the statute: confirm, deny, or adjourn and request the prosecutor to do something. Seems to be a very comprehensive and closed list of options. And it puts the prosecutor in a difficult, perhaps even impossible position to prosecute something he simply did not choose to do and may not even believe in that he can do. Whether that's for evidential reasons or for legal reasons, could be both, I guess. But it's really taking away some of the autonomy of the prosecutor and one of the tasks, I mean core tasks of any prosecutor, namely what to prosecute. The charges must be redrafted, and perhaps even worse, the trial chamber is put in a tricky position, in particular if it doesn't agree with the legal interpretation or factual interpretation made by the pretrial chamber later at trial. It can be corrected by using the same vehicle again, but that seems to be complicating the matter unnecessarily. I consider this a rather unfortunate experiment by the pretrial chamber, and so regardless of what view one takes on the basic issue of a recharacterization of charges. And luckily, in a more recent case, in one of the Kenya cases, the pretrial chamber took the opposite view and said there is no room for application of this Regulation 55 at the confirmation stage. So I guess we're back on safe ground again. In Bemba, the pretrial chamber found the better route. They adjourned the hearing, referred the matter back to the prosecutor to consider amending the charges. The prosecutor considered and amended the charges, and those charges, as amended, were essentially confirmed. What that related to was the mode of liability. The original charges were drafted for co-perpetration. What the chamber was after and what the amendment related to was rather command responsibility, and the confirmed charges relate to command responsibility and not to co-perpetration. But this pretrial chamber took a view on another issue that's more debatable, namely on cumulative charges, and it rejected charges of torture as a crime against humanity and outrages against personal dignity as a war crime on the basis that they were cumulative of rape charges in the same case. So it underscored its filtering function to extend also to declining charges, although the evidentiary standard had been met and essentially the test set out in the ICC statute was met, and referring to an inherent power of any judicial body to ensure the protection of the rights of the defense. So, i.e., cumulative charges are burdensome, unnecessarily burdensome for the defense, and the defendant should be spared such in most cases. The chamber held that the prosecution must avoid subjecting the defense to the burden of responding to multiple charges for the same facts, and by doing so risk delaying the proceedings. So it's burdensome, and in itself it delays the proceedings. And also, in slightly later, when they refused leave to appeal, also in this case, they took note of the fact that if the trial chamber is not happy with this, they can recharacterize back during the trial stage. Well, the issue whether multiple convictions can result from multiple criminal provisions is of course an issue that occurs in all legal systems, these international systems also. It was never addressed in the ICC statute, so you have no provision on it. There are certain provisions that are going in one or the other direction, as the report notes. And there is also an indication in the so-called elements of crimes, which is guidelines provided for the judges how to interpret the substantive crimes of the court and link them to the different modes of criminal responsibility. There is a reference to that a particular conduct may constitute one or more crimes. Well, that's also not rocket science, is it? The question is whether you allow it to represent one or more crimes and whether you can convict for one or more crimes, in spite of the fact that it's one conduct. Could it be both war crime of this kind and war crime of that kind at the same time? Could a particular conduct be war crime and crimes against humanity in one go and result in conviction for both? Well, the ICTY and ICTR has certainly found a solution allowing cumulative charges and cumulative convictions, and they based that theory on the Blockberger test, the US Supreme Court test in the Blockberger case, and applied it for a number of years now. It's also been adopted by the Special Court for Sierra Leone. It's been adopted, at least in principle, by the Special Tribunal for Lebanon in one of those referral matters from the pretrial chamber to the appeals chamber, and the appeals chamber expressed its interpretation of the law on cumulative charges, saying that this test should be applied by the Lebanon Tribunal as well. And it's even been applied by the extraordinary chambers of the courts of Cambodia, being very different in the basic setup in the first place. But still, on cumulative charging and convictions, they follow the principles set forth by ICTY or by the US Supreme Court from the beginning. But the ICC did not do so in the Bemba case. And one may ask whether it's better for the defendant to face, you know, a quite clear scheme of cumulative charges and cumulative convictions and know that in advance, whether that's better and less time-consuming than creating certain unclarity, which may need to be remedied by using these recharacterization mechanism later at trial, when the trial chamber finds that whoops, we need to go in a different direction and warn the parties and allow them to provide arguments on that issue much later at trial. I'm not so convinced. I'm also troubled by the fact that the ICC, without necessarily being called for it, departs from practice that seems to be settled by all the rest of their peers. I think there is a value in itself that they try to do things rather similarly rather than take opposite positions. So, this was essentially what I wanted to say on confirmation of charges. In order to conclude, the ICC confirmation process serves important purposes, and it's designed to make possible a meaningful and robust judicial review. This review should include both issues of law and issues of fact in order to be effective, but, and a very big but, it must be tightly controlled and managed by the pretrial chamber, as envisaged, in fact, in the ICC statute, in order to serve its purposes without creating a very time-consuming additional trial-like process which improperly curtails the role and responsibilities of the parties and prejudices the subsequent adjudication by the trial chamber. Certain improvements can be identified in the practice so far, in particular in the management of the hearings, but the rigorous and very detailed evaluation of factual and legal issues presented in long decisions gives the impression of a trial of sorts, albeit based upon comprised and incomplete evidence, and sometimes also one-sided, if the one other side don't show up. The quest for truth-finding and ambitions of legal perfectionism with respect to legal recharacterization of charges at this stage, with respect to the stance taken on cumulative charging, etc., do also, in my view, show an overzealousness which moves the emphasis from the trial and trial hearing to this screening and essentially preparatory process, which is unfortunate, and there are further improvements to look forward to, hopefully, as the ICC goes along with its process.
Thank you very much. We'll be open to some questions. Maybe we can open it up to the floor for questions for you. Let me start and give you guys time to think through your questions. You know my position on the confirmation of charges given our report, but just to play the devil's advocate, I mean, one of the reasons that some of the advocates of the confirmation of charges process have presented is that these cases are about war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, and that one of the key reasons for having a more robust process is that you don't want to put someone on trial, especially a big political figure, as you said in the beginning, without being quite sure that you have solid evidence to pursue that trial against those people. I mean, we have al-Bashir, we have heads of state indicted by the ICC. Why not have some level of robust process that is more than what the ICTY and ICTR does, which is essentially a one-judge, you know, written confirmation? I mean, is there a need, as some of the negotiators thought, for something more robust than the other courts? Is there a good reason for departing from the other court practice?
Coming from a system where the confirmation process in Sweden is a rubber stamping thing, I will check formal. I have a background as a judge before I started doing all this. It's essentially rubber stamping the charging sheet presented by the prosecutor without checking any evidence, but checking formalities that statutes or limitations have not come into play and that the formulation of the charges are such that you can essentially convict in the end, or if you know, real formalities, no evidentiary check, in order exactly to avoid any appearance of trying the case, but just a little and in advance. I would be perfectly happy with something quite simplified. I was convinced during our talks that others would not be happy with that. They wanted more, and they also wanted more with respect, more than ICTY and ICTR, because that was seen to be done in camera. No one really knows whether the judges even read through the papers. You sent them in, and a couple of days later they came out with a stamp on them saying, arrest the guy. And they wanted that broader. There was also the idea of, if you can't get hold of these people, at least you should provide some kind of process to highlight the plight of the victims and to show that we're serious about prosecuting by some type of hearing. And you have this special kind of in absentia confirmation hearings in the ICTY and ICTR process. which is rather to show we're after you guys, but we can't get you, and what we do instead is to show that we're serious about it. I mean, we had a bit of that in the ICC negotiations too. I thought essentially we found a fairly good balance. I could even agree to do some type of hearing or oral thing, since you do it after the person has appeared in one way or another before the court. My real problem is the presentation of live evidence and the contesting evidence being presented, making it into a, you need to check the evidence very thoroughly, and you can bring in lots of witnesses, and essentially, what's the point in the trial afterwards if you can do it already in the confirmation process? I can't see any point in doing that process. I think it's duplicates what we're doing. I think it's very dangerous with respect to the roles of the different actors involved, in particular the trial chamber. I think they must be extremely concerned by having three of their friends expressing themselves so explicitly, so in detail, so based on the same material, over 180 pages before I do it. As an appeals judge, which I was at one stage, I would be happy because I would then have a very particular function in reviewing what someone had done before me. As a trial judge, after a pre-trial judge, I would be extremely uncomfortable. So, short answer to your question, yes, I clearly think we overdid it here. And I think the court and all the friends of the courts are paying a bit for it as it is now. I think the reasons for moving beyond ICTY and ICTR, there are good reasons, but we moved a bit too far here.
Okay, just a follow-up. Given the duplication and delay that it has engendered, why do you think that the state parties aren't willing, or weren't willing, in Kampala, the review conference, or even since then, to really put pressure on a possible proposal for amending the statute to make the confirmation of charges process clearly a summary process?
Even worse, there is an amendment process after Kampala that's taking place at this very moment. There is an Assembly of State Party meeting where this will be discussed, amendments to the statute, beginning next week, is it? They will also not touch procedural issues. The crowd normally going to these events are not procedural lawyers. They are diplomats. They are terrified by the thought of going into this. And it will take a very different crowd to amend the procedures of the court. There are easier ways to do it. You can do it through the rules of procedure and evidence, which is a much more simplified process, or you can do it through the statute in order to adjust what probably needs to be adjusted with respect to confirmation. It would need to be the statute itself. That may happen one of these days, but I think for all practical purposes, the judges need to complain and make a proposal, and to use that as the point of departure, because you don't want to open up entire procedures for a renegotiation, because that's a process which would be very difficult to close in the end. So you would need a few well-defined issues based on proposals from the judges, formal or informal proposals by the judges, and then dealt with so that diplomats can decide, but send them back home to real lawyers to look through and comment upon them, but not necessarily taking part in the negotiation. Then it may happen. And these processes have not been initiated in that format yet.
My thinking is that the cost of delay is borne by state parties, so they may have an interest in efficiency of the process to the extent it reaches their pockets. Mm-hmm. Let me open up again to see if any of you have follow-up questions. Yeah.
So, at present, how much weight does the trial chamber give to the opinion by the trial chamber? Do they consider it at all, or?
No, it is a very good question. It's difficult to tell in real life how much weight they give. At least the charges as confirmed by the pretrial chamber must be binding as a matter of principle on the trial chamber. Otherwise, there is no use to have the pretrial, the confirmation process. And if you want to amend that, you have two options. Either to send new reformulated charges back for a new confirmation round, which you may do before the trial has started, or to allow certain amendments in the trial process, either called for by the parties or called for by the court in a recharacterization. But the charges as such must be binding. All the other 186 pages of the decision arguably cannot be binding on the trial chamber, because if they were, they would become some kind of appeals process and not a trial process. So I think most of the words are spilt ink, to be honest, in the confirmation decisions.
Yeah, Jan.
Do you think that it is convenient the role that the jury trial chamber has on in terms of the amended indictment of the prosecutor? I mean, for the trial, the pre-trial chamber to say to the prosecutor, okay, amend the charges this way or the other, that is not biased, like, in some way, and that is not like violate the presumption of innocence.
That is a very good point. When we drafted it, I thought that was very odd. In particular, since a rejection does not prevent the prosecutor from come back and knock on the door again. I would personally have been absolutely happy with thumbs up, thumbs down. Yes or no. And no other explanations. And perhaps that might be a way to refrain the pretrial chamber from being too much a legal think tank. They don't need to tell why, I mean, in very detailed terms, why they are taking all these little turns. And perhaps that might be a way for the future to avoid them digging too deep into the legal assessment and legal interpretations of the material. Because I agree with you, I think it is slightly uncomfortable that the court is so explicit. If you do this, we will probably think differently than we do here today. It's of course not the convict, non-convict, and it's rather to set the stage for the trial process. But as a matter of principle, what the court should or should not do, I tend to agree with you.
So because like the pretrial chamber goes so in depth into the evidence and everything, does it mean that once a case passed the pretrial, the defendant is no longer presumed innocent?
Mm-hmm. What does confirmation mean?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's also a good question. I mean, as soon as you start any type of evidentiary evaluation, you kind of tip the scale one way or another. You don't go as far as you do at trials. You don't speak at all whether the evidence is sufficient for a conviction or not. I mean, you're far behind that level. And you would have it regardless of whether you have the ICTR prima facie test or if you have the ICC's substantial grounds to believe test. As soon as you do evidentiary evaluation, you at least provide something, arguments for guilt rather than innocence. On the other hand, even the issuance of an arrest warrant, which is based on a suspicion, would do something similar. And you would have confirmation-type processes and arrest warrant based on some type of evidentiary evaluation in all domestic legal systems. So obviously we don't generally believe that this type of testing means that the presumption of innocence has been harmed. But I mean, you can certainly make the argument.
And the question's a valid one after a 180-page decision. detailing all the evidence that goes to each element of crime and motor responsibility. So I think you're not alone in raising that. Any other thoughts or questions here? If not, help me in thanking. Join me in thanking Hakan Freeman for his insight.
Taking time off from
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I give you the devil's advocate question because, of course, you know I'm very critical of the process. And from a common law lawyer perspective, it makes absolutely